Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Today, the court has three cousins on its oral submission docket. In the order of the presentation, they are City of Austin versus the Travis County Landfill Company from Travis County and the 3rd Appellate District, and in the matter of RJH, also from Travis County and the 3rd Appellate District. And this afternoon at 2 o'clock, we will hear the third case, N. Ray, Rick Perry, and Henry Cuellar, a petition for writ of mandamus. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in City of Austin versus Travis County Landfill Company.
May it please the court, Ms. Pam Barron, who present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is a taking by overflight case, which is not your typical takings case. Unlike an entry onto the surface of land, the mere passage of aircraft through airspace above property is not in and of itself a taking. Because the air is a public highway, a taking occurs if and only if the flights are so low and so frequent that the flights themselves result in a direct, immediate, and substantial interference with use and enjoyment of the property. The issue in this case is whether the landfill company has met the constitutionally required showing of substantial interference with use and enjoyment of its property by reason of civilian flights in and out of Austin Bergstrom Airport.
Let me ask you, I was a bit surprised in reading the response brief in this case at the way the issue was framed, and I'd like to hear your take on that. In the summary of the argument, TCLC claims that its takings case is not predicated on the loss of its ability to expand the landfill, and they specifically say when TCLC bought the property, it acquired the right to exclude overflights by civilian cargo and passenger jetliners, period. Where do they derive that right to exclude from? They seem to be indicating that they don't need to show any sort of interference, that when they bought the property, there was somehow a right to exclude civilian flight.
There is no right to exclude. I think the Supreme Court clearly said in Cosby, and it was reiterated in the Brown versus United States case out of the Federal Circuit in 96, that there's no per se taking just from airplanes passing over your property. But I think you're right in observing that the nature of the dispute has changed substantially and narrowed quite a bit based on the response brief on the merits, because in the trial court, counsel for the landfill company was arguing that the inability to vertically expand supported the substantial interference prong of the takings test.
Well, that's the way I had read it
right
up until this point.
And that's what we've been arguing about, is whether or not pre-existing limitations on height, like the clearance easement that the city owns that prevents them from vertically expanding, could show substantial interference when they were already in place on the property. Now what they're saying is that liability was not predicated on the inability to vertically expand, and instead they're now submitting that just potential risk and hazards from operating near the airport and under the glide slope standing alone constitutes substantial interference.
And that, are you aware of any authority to support that proposition?
No, and I don't think it fits in with the overflight case jurisprudence that we have. And all three courts of appeals justices recognize that this case doesn't look like a typical overflight case. In all of those cases, there was some effect of the airplanes themselves, like noise or vibrations or jet fuel spray or something that materially altered the way the plaintiff could use the property.
Well, and that gets to my next question. How are we to evaluate this case? Is this a defective charge case or a no-evidence case?
It's a no-evidence case, because whether particular facts rise to the level of taking is a question of law. The court stated that very recently in the General Service Commission versus Little Tex case, and I can give you the cite on that. That was 39 Southwest 3rd at 598. And before that, in the Mayhew case versus Town of Sunnyvale, same analysis. And in fact, the court relied on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in an overflight case, Cosby, for the proposition that whether particular facts give rise to the level of interference necessary to prove a taking is a question of law. But this case, in
Cosby... But there is the argument that the charge was incorrect because it asked the jury as a part of the takings, whether or not there was a takings, to determine if there was a diminution in value of the property.
Right.
So is there some evidence that supports that finding?
Well, the jury was asked whether there was a substantial decrease in market value. And if you look at the record, almost all of the testimony in the record does not relate to the effect of just the overflights. Their expert appraisal witness was asked to compare two scenarios, and those were the land with the airport and the land without the airport, not the land with the overflights and the land without the overflights.
So you're arguing, even if the charge is correct charge, there's still no evidence supporting that.
That's correct.
On the charge error thing, I'm confused. The majority opinion in the Court of Appeals said that there was a preservation problem and held that the city didn't preserve it. The dissent talks about charge error and says, well, yes, they did. But it looked like they were talking about two different things. Do I understand your charge error is the or phrase of part three of that question as opposed to part two? That there was a diminution of the market value.
Well, I think there were two complaints about the charge. One was that a change in market value standing alone does not constitute taking, but the other is that it failed to exclude changes in value or interference attributable to the existing clearance easement that limited the height of the landfill anyway. And so the jury was permitted to base a finding of substantial on what the appraiser testified was really a substantial change by reason of the airport and these other restrictions on the property, not a change based on just the flights themselves. So I think there were two different complaints on the charge.
Ms. Merriman, but if your complaint about the charge is an alternative ground for reversal and need not be reached if we agree that there's no evidence of a taking.
That's correct.
If we agree that there's no evidence of a physical taking by the overflights, which are the first issues that you present, then is there any need to reach the regulatory taking issue, or is that too an alternative argument?
Well, the regulatory takings issue is not so much an issue as an example of how it can be avoided by claiming their airplanes through the property, but the airplanes themselves aren't causing the harm. It's really the regulation that's causing the harm. So it's an end run on a regulatory taking. It's not a direct issue. It's just showing the problem with this case when you allow a lack of causation, basically, between the flights and the harm claimed. And if you put this case in the context of the overflight cases, which, as I said, the court feels recognized this doesn't fit. In Cosby, for example, the plaintiff could no longer use their land as a commercial chicken farm. And in Griggs and McFadden, residential property was rendered just uninhabitable. And even in Brown versus United States, which is the most recent overflight case we have from the Federal Circuit in 96, there wasn't very much current use of the property except for hunting, but the plaintiffs nonetheless alleged that noise from jet military flights over the property fundamentally altered the nature of the property so that it's no longer fit for recreational development but could only be put to agricultural use.
The landowner cites Brown for the proposition that the substantial interference test may be met by showing a current decrease in market value or by proof of adverse impact on some reasonably foreseeable future use. What's your comment on that?
Well, I think what Brown says is that a significant decline in market value, which decline is directly attributable to the overflights,
as opposed to
something else, is strong support, but they don't go so far as to say standing alone it's enough. But in that case, there was an indication that the overflights, or an allegation that the overflights, changed the use from recreational to agricultural. Here, we don't have that situation. First, the landfill company's not complaining about any physical effects of the overflight, like noise and vibrations, which you see in these other cases. They're also not saying that the fundamental nature of their property has changed. It's undisputed in the record that the highest and best use of the property, both before and after the alleged taking, is as a landfill. And Mr. Mays, the general manager of the company, admitted at trial that there was no impediment to moving forward under the permit as issued. So under these cases, the types of claims we have here, potential risk and hazards, don't rise to the level, the constitutional level, of substantial interference. I guess I want to talk a little bit about, even if we get there, there's no showing in this record that potential risk and hazards rise to the level of substantial. And I did have this little bench book that has some record excerpts. I won't go into it at great length. But basically, when you look at this record, as I said before, you have to keep in mind that very little of the testimony relates just to the overflights.
$3 million is
substantial. It's substantial, but you have to remember that what they were comparing is the land with no airport, as if there were no airport near it, no clearance easement, no military flights over the property, versus the land with all of those items in place. And so most, if not all, appears to be attributable to the height restrictions on the property, because most of the testimony had to do with how the landfill property could be expanded under an expanded permit, how much more capacity they would have, that it would have 6 years longer life, and so forth. Let me show you what the testimony is on just on the overflights. And if you look behind tab one, this is the testimony from Clint Sayers, who's the expert appraisal witness for the plaintiff. And on the bottom of the first page, highlighted in orange, you'll see here's what the task he was asked to do. And it was to compare two scenarios, with and without the airport. And I think you'll probably hear in the response argument that he testified that there was a 5% increased risk factor between his two scenarios. But you have to keep in mind that that's risk with and without the airport, not with and without the overflights. If you turn to page 185, which should be after that little passage, I'll just show you what he says about the effect of just the overflights on the property. First, he's asked, well, is it going to affect people coming and using the landfill? And he says, no, overflights are not going to affect that. On the next page, here he's comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges. And he says, the risk on the property after the alleged taking is exactly the same as it was in 1988 when the permit issued. So there's not a change in risk from the property burdened and then with the overflights. And then finally, the last little part I'll talk about is kind of a group of questions. First, he's asked, were you asked to look at just the overflights as part of your assignment? He says, no. But then counsel for the landfill company says, well, do you have an opinion anyway about whether or not these flights constitute a direct and immediate interference? And he wasn't asked if it was substantial. And all he could come up with is, well, yeah, only to the extent that it adds potential hazards to the property. And then when asked if he had ever calculated what the cost of those hazards are, he says, no, I have not calculated that. So at best in this record, the direct effect of overflights is unquantified potential hazards that are never testified to as being substantial. And for that reason, we have no evidence of substantial interference, even by potential risk and hazards, assuming they met the constitutional level of substantial interference in the first place.
Let me, going back to the charge, you're arguing about a substantial impact on the property. It seemed to me a lot of the argument was whether or not that could be shown simply by showing a diminution in value of the property. If there is some evidence of diminution in value of the property, it seems to me we have to address whether or not that is an element of a takings claim as opposed to the damages part of it. Are you basically agreeing that under Brown, diminution in value is some evidence of a taking, or I mean, are some part of an element of taking, or?
Well, I think there are two parts to Brown. Brown says it's strong support. Normally, you're not going to have a significant decline in market value directly attributable to overflights unless there's some fundamental change in the way the property can be used. But what Brown also says is that minor indirect speculative changes in value don't get you there. And if you might remember, the courts used sort of a similar analysis in State versus Hill, which was the materially and substantially impaired access to property.
So if the charge is incorrect, it would be the failure to say a substantial diminution in value as opposed to a diminution in value.
It says substantial, but there's no evidence that it is substantial. But in State versus Hill, for example, the issue there is material and substantially impaired access, and there was expert testimony that the road improvements or changes did add more confusion, add more hazard, made it more difficult, and did affect market value. And this court held as a matter of law that that doesn't get you to materially and substantially.
It seems to me substantial would be a major problem. Determining what is substantial, certainly leaving it up to the jury to decide what's substantial. If you look at Brown, would it be not a diminution in value, but a substantial change in the use of the property, or affecting a substantial change in the use of, would that be a, if that is an element, wouldn't that be an easier element to evaluate the jury's fact-finding process than saying a substantial drop in the value of property?
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I do think that Brown says that a significant decline attributable to overflights is support, but it doesn't get you all the way there. And in that case, there was a change in use, and that is easier to evaluate. But in Mayhew, for example, in State versus Hill, this court deals with those issues in a constitutional setting all the time. And it may not be easy, but you do it.
I'd like to ask you a question about the abrogation. Is that how you pronounce that?
I think so.
If I'm a little confused about how that works. It appears in this case there was a negotiated abrogation easement, which is in that deed.
Yes.
Meaning that it's a compensable theory, that they have to buy from the landowner the right to do what they bargained for here. Mm-hmm. By the same token, can there be the elements of an abrogation easement that brings about a taking that now, say in this case, would cause the state actor to be liable for whatever damages the jury might be found? Is that how that could work?
Well, I think if they showed a substantial new and different interference with a property that wasn't pre-existing, mm-hmm. that there could be...
Well, let me take it to another way. That if the abrogation easement didn't exist in this deed, in this case, mm-hmm. could they prove a taking by showing the elements of what an abrogation is and say, and therefore we're entitled to compensation under that theory?
Well, you have to show three things to get an abrogation easement. You have to show the flights are directly over the property, that they're low and frequent, and that they result in a substantial interference. So if they met that, yes.
So the jury question that was involved here with the three parts is basically submitting the elements of an abrogation easement.
Well, basically it's submitting the question of a taking. It's really just a question of law that was submitted
to the
jury.
And so part two in there has to do with the regulatory limits of 500 feet in uncongested areas.
Goes to whether or not they're low mm-hmm. enough to be a compensable taking.
And let me just follow up on that questioning real quickly and make sure I understand the analysis here. There didn't have to be an abrogation easement. I mean, absent, there's no requirement that an airport, before they begin operation, military or civilian, go out and acquire airspace rights over contiguous property.
That's correct.
And so if there were no military abrogation easement, then there would be a burden of proof taken in order for there to be compensation for the landowners. I mean, is it fair to say that the abrogation easement is bought just as a precaution against the takings claim, that there's no requirement that it be bought?
There is no requirement. It often is when there are uses that are incompatible with loud airplanes going overhead like a school or residences.
And my question, and the purpose of that is to avoid
claims to protect like against a taking claim. Exactly.
But there's no right to have those bought out.
No, and there's no right to exclude. That's correct. Right.
Any other questions?
I got one more. What about the argument that the city can't rely on that avocation easement because it's limited to military aircraft.
Well, I think that's correct. I don't think it protects the city if there's a showing that the civilian flights result in substantial interference under these cases. I will note, though, that there still are military flights in and out of Austin Bergstrom under that military avocation easement.
And that's in the record?
Yes. Do you want? I can give you a cite for that, too. It's at Volume 2 of the Reporter's Record, pages 38, 39, 56, 57, and one Reporter's Record, 229 through 30.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
The Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Okay, Court, Mr. John Lynch will present argument for the respondent.
Good place, Court. Good morning. Chief Craig Gustus Jefferson. At the time of trial, the evidence was 25 military flights had used the airstrip. Almost 6,500 civilian flights had used the airstrip outside the scope of the avocation of the overflight easement.
Mr. McLeish, would you just go right to the heart of the matter and tell us what evidence there is in the record of a substantial interruption of the use and enjoyment of the property as a result of the overflights themselves as opposed to anything else?
There are three elements of the damages that both sides proved to the court and the jury. Because these overflights are so low, because they come so close to the surface, the ability of the landowner to expand this landfill.
Wait a minute.
It's gone.
And this is where I'm confused, and this was my original question. My understanding is you're not relying on the inability to vertically expand to constitute a taking.
As a part of the analysis for liability for a taking.
You're not relying on, so you're not saying
that's part of the damages that the landowner suffers.
Right. So the inability to expand the landfill vertically is not an interference that you're claiming forms the basis of the takings claim.
It forms the basis of a part of the takings claim to the extent that proof of damages is proof of substantial interference, because that's the way we have to calculate damages in Texas condemnation cases.
Well, the statement in your brief is TCLC's liability case is not predicated upon the loss of its ability to expand the landfill. Your liability case is not predicated on that.
It's predicated on the right to exclude, which our United States Supreme Court says is the basis of the common law right to property ownership.
But you just now said that the ability to expand shows substantial interference, which shows liability.
It's part of the evidence that supports that allegation.
I don't understand the statement is not predicated upon. What does that mean?
Because the predicate, the proof that the landowner has to make, the second showing, the second hurdle he has to get by to even get to the question of substantial interference and damages, is whether his airspace is uniquely impacted as opposed to all the other people out there. Everybody has to agree to put up with flights that are above the level of 500 feet. But in federal jurisprudence, where flights come below the level of 500 feet, the 500-foot rule, where they come below that level, the courts find that that is an invasion of the landowner's airspace that he's entitled to use and control for his benefit. And that, I think, is the predicate for a finding before you ever get to the issue of substantial interference and damages. That's the predicate for the landowner's
claim. And is your theory that once it's established that that airspace is invaded, that there is automatically a right to compensation?
No, ma'am. I don't think there is. I personally think there should be, because I don't know why a overflight case should be treated differently than any other physical invasion case. If you read the Supreme Court's physical invasion cases.
All right, I understand you disagree. But
I agree there has to be proof of a substantial interference with the landowner's use and enjoyment of this property. That's another.
All right, and what is the substantial interference that you're relying on here?
Reduction in the size of the landfill, increased risk in operating,
not
and increased cost in operating.
Not reduction, inability to expand.
Yes, ma'am. He wasn't able to build this landfill as large as he as he would have been able to.
All right. Now, why does the overflight change that situation? Let's say that this airport were still as it originally was. It was still a military operation.
They were still flying military planes through this airspace.
Just as it was.
That would be privileged.
I'm sorry?
They would be privileged. If they were flying within the scope of the easement that they had,
right,
they would be privileged. As long as they didn't fly more than 60,900 flights per year, the military would be privileged.
So you have to show then that there is an incremental difference between the civilian overflights and the way the airport was before in order to show a substantial taking.
I think we have to show invasions of the airspace that are outside of the scope of the easement that privileges those overflights.
And that does not appear to be what the proof at trial was. It appears that the proof at trial was between airport, no airport, versus civilian airport, military airport.
That's the way that damages are required to be calculated in Texas condemnation law and in federal condemnation law, and the law of every jurisprudence in the United States that I'm aware of. The measure of damages is the difference between the value of the property before the taking.
Before the taking.
And
before
the taking, consideration of the project that's charged with the taking.
Before the taking.
Yes, ma'am.
And the taking here was from the civilian use.
When the city started flying on June the 15th, 1997.
That's yes, right?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So it was the civilian use. So immediately before the civilian use was the military use.
There was no use. The airport was closed. The government of the United States had ordered the airport closed. They ordered the real property assets there sold, including the easement that burdened my client's property. And under federal law, that easement is offered first to them as the owners of the fee, unless somebody comes forward and says they need it for
whether it was closed or not, there was a right to use it for military overflight. So then the point in time you have to look at, I would think, would be at the time of the taking, is the right to use it for military versus civilian.
Yes, ma'am.
And it seems the proof at trial ignored the fact that there was a right to use it for military and just presumed no airport.
No, ma'am. The proof at trial from their witness, from Holly Young, their witness was that the few military flights they were using it at that time were purely transient military flights, that they were only coming there because the city was operating the airport. The proof at trial was, as of the date of taking, but for the project charged with the taking, but for the city's deciding to use this for a civilian airport, as of the date of taking, that military navigation easement didn't mean anything anymore.
But it still existed.
It did exist.
I mean, there still was the right of the government to fly military flights over that property under the navigation easement. That had not gone away.
That navigation easement existed, and it's like any other restriction on the landowner's ability to use his property when you're analyzing the value of the whole property.
You said that there were three, you were going to tell us about three pieces of evidence that showed substantial interference with the use and enjoyment of the property. The first, you said, was the ability to expand vertically. What are the other two?
The increased risk of operating, because the flights are so low that there's an enhanced risk of bird impact, bird strike, or other catastrophic risk, and increased operating costs. All of the witnesses that testified on this issue agreed that all three of those things were present as an adverse impact directly of the overflights, because the airplanes were coming so near the ground at this point that you had to incur additional cost in operating your landfill. You had additional risk from bird strikes.
Was that quantified? Was there a dollar figure put on the risk of just the possibility of additional bird strikes? I mean, I understand that there's a lot of confusion about the bird strike issue. It appears that you can't get your Type 4 permit without showing birds are not a problem. And also, this is a Type 4 landfill that there's argument that doesn't attract birds. But in any event, assuming that there is a bird problem and increased hazard, was there a quantifiable amount put on that before the taking and after the taking?
No. There was not an allocation among all these issues of what the value was, of which element contributed what amount to the decrease in value. Both appraisers found that these three elements contributed to a decrease in the value of the property. The city's appraiser, $2.3 million, Argap, $3.6 million.
But again, that was based on no airport versus airport rather than military versus civilian.
Yes, ma'am, but I hasten to point out to you the only evidence in the record that there was any adverse impact on this property because of the operation of the airport was because of the overflights. If you look at the exhibits that I've given you, if you look at Exhibit 1 and roll it out there and see all the property around this airport that's impacted by one of the height hazard ordinances that the city has enacted. The evidence at this trial is that almost all of those properties are enhanced by the operation of this airport.
Mr. McClish, when you talk about increased risk of operating the airport as evidence of substantial interference, before the civilian flights started, it was being used as a landfill. Now that the civilian flights are going over the property, it's still being used as a landfill. There's been no difference in the use of the way the property is used or the way it can be used since the civilian flights started. I have a hard time understanding how that can be substantial interference if, in fact, it in no way has affected the use of the property.
It's not worth as much. It's not worth nearly as much.
You said that the increased risk of operating was evidence of substantial interference, and I'm not understanding how that does interfere when, in fact, a landfill was being operated on the property before the overflights began. A landfill is being operated now that the flights are occurring on a daily basis. So what I need to know is why that is evidence under the United States Supreme Court's jurisprudence in the overflight area of evidence of substantial use of interference.
Interference
of use and enjoyment.
I want to read to you from the United States Supreme Court's jurisprudence because I think
important. I need for you to just explain. I'm just not connecting in terms of how increased risk of operating amounts to substantial interference. When in fact, you're still operating a landfill.
You can still operate a landfill, but there's a big difference if it's worth $3 million less because of these overflight operations. And the undisputed evidence at trial was it's worth less.
But it's not worth less because of the increased risk. You just, in answer to Justice O'Neill's question, said that there was no evidence quantifying that. And in fact, wasn't the evidence of the diminution in value associated with the fact that you're unable to expand the landfill vertically?
No, ma'am. As a matter of fact, there are three elements that both appraisers found contributed to the decrease in value of the market value of the property. Neither of the appraisers, properly under Texas law, under the Westgate opinion, neither of the appraisers segregated the elements of damages and found this amount for one purpose and this amount for another. They found the value of the property before and the value of the property after. One of them thought it was $2.3 million. One of them thought it was $3.6
million. And what was the cause of the diminution of value?
Increased risk was one of the causes to both of the appraisers. Increased cost was one of the causes to both of the appraisers. Decreased capacity was one of the causes to both of the appraisers. There's Emily.
But how was that evidence connected to overflights as opposed to being connected to the fact that this landfill is next to an airport, and as a result, there are zoning restrictions in terms of what you can build and how you can build it. There was a clearance easement that was part of the easement in this property with respect to this property that pre-existed your clients owning the property. I mean, again, it ties back to, yes, diminution of value can be evidence of damage, but before you get to that, you've got to show the substantial interference caused by the overflights as opposed to something else. And that's what I'm having a hard time understanding and why I keep repeating the question so I understand your position clearly. How does it tie specifically to the overflights?
I think that my first answer is, substantial diminution in market value, according to the United States Supreme Court's decision in Cosby, is conclusive evidence of substantial interference with the use and enjoyment of the land.
As long as it's caused by the overflights as opposed to something else. And that's what I read in Cosby, and that's what I read in Brown, and that's what I read in Griggs. And that's the connecting piece that I'd like for you to help me with if you can.
Well, the first thing that I need to say about that is it's not the jury's finding of that that the court should be analyzing. It is the court's finding of fact number 5, in which she found both a substantial interference with TCLC's ability to use and enjoy its land and a substantial decrease in market value, both of those caused by.
Well, then are you agreeing that we don't have, that this is a question of law for the court to decide and we should be disregarding the jury findings?
Absolutely. On the issue of liability, absolutely, I agree that. We submitted a question to the jury because of the state of the federal jurisprudence at the time. It has been clarified. Nobody thinks that an inverse case is a cause of action in common law under the Seventh Amendment anymore. And I thought at the time that was a question for the judge, and I certainly think so now.
Is it true that at the time of trial, the property was still undeveloped raw land.
No, it was not raw land. It was not developed as a landfill, but it was permitted as a landfill. The evidence is that the landowner has spent almost $1 million obtaining the entitlements to operate it as a landfill.
Well, have they done anything on the land to operate it as a landfill?
No, sir, they had not.
So when it says undeveloped raw land, you take issue with undeveloped? Or
yes.
Anything that happened out there besides getting a permit?
I think there's a big difference in Texas law between property that's zoned and permitted and platted for a residential subdivision and property that just has that potential, and I think that's the difference here.
I'm just trying to understand if questions have been asked about the operation of a landfill, but a landfill has never been operated there. Is that true?
As of the time of trial, no landfill had been operated there.
Well, has it changed?
That's outside the record, but yes, sir, there's a landfill operating there now. We do not contest the fact that the property was still suitable to be used for a landfill after the taking. That was our evidence at trial. That was their evidence at trial. The evidence of decrease in market value is, although the parties had a different number, they both had the same evidence on that issue.
It's hard for me to, the diminution in, when the landfill was permitted, there was an anticipation they could pile up the garbage so many feet high.
Yes,
soon.
Yes, sir.
And with the civilian, they could not have done that with the military overflights. But there was some period of time when the military shut down the airbase and it was abandoned, and before the city took over, that there was some anticipation by the people who bought the property that they could now build they could pile up the garbage higher than under the abrogation easement. So they did that. And then they buy the property and the city comes in and starts operating the airport. And now these overflights start again. And the diminution in the value is because they no longer can pile the garbage up as high as they thought they'd otherwise be able to in the absence of the abrogation easement. Is that what the diminution in the value is? It's because they cannot now pile it up as high as they thought they could have prior to the city opening the airport?
Their damages include that element because...
But that is the element.
Right.
That is their damage.
That's one of the three elements of damages. Yes, sir, it is.
Well, but what other elements of damage are there?
Increased operating costs and increased risk of operating with the low overflights coming by. Everybody said that was true. The director of solid waste for the city of Austin testified that was true.
Increased risk that you'll build a pile too high and a plane will hit it, or
that a plane will hit a bird that happens to be hanging around your landfill, yep, where you have a requirement to disperse the birds and you get sued. I think is the
except
exactly
that the permit four took care of that.
No, sir. That's an allegation that's not supported by the evidence in this case, and you need to look at the...
So what you take on some liability that your operations might do something that interferes with planes flying there, independent of the height of the
absolutely
pile.
Absolutely, and it's interesting, the evidence makes it very specific. The city of Austin's landfill, which is shown on the exhibits I've given the court, it's immediately adjacent to our property to the east. But it's outside the glide slope. It's outside the slope of where the airplanes fly. So, and the evidence was they were not restricted by 1 cubic yard in the quantity of fill that they were allowed to put on their property. Nevertheless, the city recognized when it put its airport out there that there was going to be a diminution in the value of the landfill that the city owned and operated out there of $1.5 million, even though they did not lose one single yard.
Was that property burdened by an easement, an abrogation easement?
No, ma'am. It was not burdened by an abrogation easement. It was burdened by a clearance easement, interestingly enough, but not one that impacted the ability of the city to go as high as engineering constraints would allow. They were allowed to permit their landfill.
What did they base the diminution in value on there?
Increased cost of operation and the risk that they might have a bird strike hazard. That's the undisputed testimony from their own director of solid waste.
What are the increased costs in this record regarding this piece of property?
The increased costs involve the daily way in which the landowner has to that they have to do, they have to cover up their field a lot faster, and they can't compact it as well. So they get lower yield, and they have to have more people working and more equipment working all the time.
And is that because of the nature of the permit and the type of landfill that they're operating, the issue that developed over birds and what kinds of things could be put in the landfill?
This is a special requirement imposed on this landfill permit and not imposed on others because of the overflights, because the airplane flies in close.
Because of the potential for birds to be on the property?
Yes, ma'am. That's one of the reasons.
And that had to do with getting the Type 4 landfill permit that you got as opposed to a Type 1 landfill permit.
We were not allowed to get a Type 1 landfill permit at all. A Type 4 landfill permit was only issued with the understanding, with the agreement by both my clients and by the city, that permanent bird dispersion programs would be maintained.
And so the result, so those increased costs are the result of the permitting process, not the result of overflights going over the property every day.
I guess it depends on which end of the telescope you're looking at.
I'm still working on this causation piece of it. The permit, in order for you to run the landfill, you had to be permitted.
Yes, ma'am.
And you were permitted to run a certain type of landfill which required you to undertake certain operations.
Yes, ma'am.
If you wanted to run a landfill. But the overflights are still happening every day, and the overflights are not causing you to do the increased costs. Aren't the permits causing you to do it?
The overflights were the only reason that was included in the permit.
Wait a minute.
It was permitted under the military navigation easement, right?
Yes, it was.
And so, therefore, you had to have a bird dispersion program because of the military navigation easement.
Yes, ma'am, we did.
Well, what's changed? Now, where is the proof that somehow the bird problems has increased because it's now civilian in nature?
Well, there is proof on that point, as a matter of fact, and I need to bring it to your attention. The military users of the airport allowed permitting for Type 4 back in 1988. In 1988, the Federal Aviation Administration had an absolute rule prohibiting any kind of a landfill within 10,000 feet of the end of the strip. Type 1, Type 4, no kind of landfill got to be at the end of the strip. They were absolutely prohibited. So, historically at least, the Federal Aviation Administration, the civil arm of the airport controllers,
and that
if you
would
will,
have been okay.
I'm sorry?
Under the navigation easement in place, they could have completely forbidden you to build any sort of a landfill.
And they proposed it.
And you'd have no claim.
Well, they would have to pass. What they did was budget enough money in their budget to buy our entire permit, to buy our whole property. And the reason that they were going to the federal government to try to get them to let us operate on a limited basis, because they didn't want to have to pay for the entire permit. That's the testimony in the case. That's the evidence in the case. They admitted that in the trial of the case, that the reason they went to the federal government and got this change in the FAA's regulations to allow a landfill this close to the end of the runway was so they wouldn't have to buy the whole thing. They recognized their obligation to buy it and budgeted money for it in their first budget to build this airport. That's the evidence in our case.
And under what authority would they have been required to go out and buy that property, considering the fact they had the abrogation easement?
Riggs versus Allegheny County is the Supreme Court of the United States' most recent writing on this subject. It's about a civilian airport. It's about a property that's exactly the same distance from the end of the airport as our property is in a civilian airport. And what the Supreme Court of the United States said in Riggs versus Allegheny County, what it implied very clearly, was that the approach area, which is what our property is in this case, it is the final approach area, the area where the planes fly too close to the ground to be normal level of navigation. The approach area is as much a part of the airport as the land that the strip sits on. And the failure to acquire the navigation easements or the property rights that are needed to fly airplanes through the approach area is a constitutionally deficient acquisition. What the Supreme Court said was, in designing the airport, they had to acquire some property. Our conclusion is that by constitutional standards, they did not acquire enough. And they were talking about exactly the approach area at exactly the same distance from the runway as our property is in relation to this airport, to this strip. So it seems to me the question is not...
Well, that, is that Greek?
Yes, Griggs, I've cited in our reply brief on the merits.
That's all the rest of your argument irrelevant, if that's true. I mean, you don't have to prove these three elements.
Because the Court of Claims, the United States Court of Claims, and in response to that, the Federal Courts of Appeals have typically fallen back on the three tests in Cosby and have not been willing to take the argument in Griggs to the next step. I will say, Justice Gilson, that I am unaware of any case in federal jurisprudence that has held there was not a taking where the landowner showed repeated flights below the level of safe navigation and made some proof that his property had been decreased in value.
In none of those cases was there a navigation easement pre-existing?
Yes, ma'am. In many of those cases, there was a navigation pre-existing. In many of those cases, there was an easement already acquired, many times through limitations, by the flights of military airplanes into an airport. And when they came later and began to fly more airplanes, or when they came later and began to fly bigger and heavier airplanes, the court determined that there had been a second taking of a navigation easement that required the government to pay additional damages to the landowner. And in the Court of Claims jurisprudence, because the Court of Claims hears cases against the United States, and they typically hear these military cases, most of the overflight navigation cases are those kinds of cases where somebody comes to the court and says, there's been another taking, there's been a second taking, an increased taking, because...
And that's because there's a substantial interference with the use of the property, and those have all involved fumes, smoke, noise, vibrations, businesses going under, whereas here, I'm having a hard time, as Justice Hankinson is, with seeing where the difference is before it was a Type 4 landfill, after it was a Type 4 landfill. Before it couldn't expand vertically, after it couldn't expand vertically. So where is the substantial change?
I can only tell you that in those cases, the airplanes were flying the same glide slope. Bigger airplanes were flying the same glide slope as the littler airplanes were flying, or they were flying more airplanes. They were flying F-4s, which were louder. For some reason, there was a reason for the landowner to complain, and the Court of Claims did not characterize it in terms of substantial interference.
But in Griggs, as in the other cases, as Justice O'Neill just said, the substantial interference, for example, in Griggs...
And in the Court of Claims jurisprudence, because the Court of Claims hears cases against the United States, and they typically hear these military cases, most of the overflight navigation cases are those kinds of cases where somebody comes to the court and says, there's been another taking, there's been a second taking, an increased taking, because...
And that's because there's a substantial interference with the use of the property, and those have all involved fumes, smoke, noise, vibrations, businesses going under, whereas here, I'm having a hard time, as Justice Hankinson is, with seeing where the difference is before it was a Type 4 landfill, after it was a Type 4 landfill. Before it couldn't expand vertically, after it couldn't expand vertically. So where is the substantial change?
I can only tell you that in those cases, the airplanes were flying the same glide slope. Bigger airplanes were flying the same glide slope as the littler airplanes were flying, or they were flying more airplanes. They were flying F-4s, which were louder. For some reason, there was a reason for the landowner to complain, and the Court of Claims did not characterize it in terms of substantial interference.
But in Griggs, as in the other cases, as Justice O'Neill just said, the substantial interference, for example, in Griggs dealt with the homeowner who had the problem with the noise and the rattling and the can't sleep at night and all of those kinds of things that were caused by the overflights themselves.
Same thing.
So we still have the substantial interference evident as a result of the overflight in Griggs as we do in all the other cases, which interfered then with the use of the property as a residential property.
Same thing in Cosby.
Couldn't live there.
Same thing in Cosby. But when the Supreme Court of the United States set out to decide what evidence it takes to meet the substantial interference test, right after the part of that case they like the best, which is private flights over land are not a taking unless they are so low that they interfere with the landowner's enjoyment, the Supreme Court of the United States in its next sentence says, the Court of Claims found there was a substantial reduction in the market value of the property, and that's enough.
But that
we don't have
to
talk about
substantial. But that was because in Cosby, there was actual evidence of the overflights affecting the property. Then you could look to diminution in value as a result of the overflight. The kind of evidence of noise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that we see in the overflight cases. So you can't take that sentence out of context when it's concluding as a result of those activities of the overflight. And that's the part that I'm having a hard time with.
My best answer to that is that the trial court, we agree, makes this factual determination that, that if there's evidence in the record to support it, if there's any evidence in the record to support it, binds this court, the trial court found that because of the overflight.
But if there's no evidence, then that finding doesn't stand.
And it's, and that's the government's burden to show you in this case that there's no evidence to support the property.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I want to talk a little bit about those second takings cases. In the respondent's brief on the merit, they cite the Avery and Davis cases, and in both those cases we had very similar effects, B-52 bombers and similar very loud and heavy aircraft had been introduced over the property, noise, vibrations, can't sleep, can't talk on the phone, can't get telephone reception, so that resident, and it was over residential property, that basically became not useful as a residence. I think what we have here is a disjunct between the constitutional standard and then the damages question. They're not, cannot be commingled, and the burden is to come forward and show that the overflights as opposed to something else came in and substantially impacted the use of the property, which we don't have in this case.
But can additional costs associated with overflights be enough to... for us to conclude that there has been substantial interference? What if we accept the argument that because of the overflight, much more money that has to be spent on costs associated with litigation, you know, for potential hazards from the birds, you know, over the landfill, or, you know, other things that would impact the business interest of the landfill itself? Could that be substantial interference?
I think it would be a tough showing. We're talking about significant decreases in market value, even if, assuming market value is the proper standard, it'd have to be at least significant, immediate, and attributable to the overflights. And when you just have increased operating costs in place, I think it's going to be a rare case where that rises to significant decrease without a fundamental change in the underlying way you can use the property. Like we see in these other overflight cases where homes can't be used anymore or commercial chicken farms can't no longer be viable under the plains as operating. None of these cases do we have a pre-existing easement that prevents the building up above the ceiling of the airspace. And this easement has been in place since 1982. So any hopes that they're going to be able to expand this landfill have been false hopes through this case and expectations that they never had a right to expect. And Mr. Mays, the general manager of the company, did testify at trial that he understood that this easement was on the property, that it was assignable, and that it was perpetual, and perpetual means forever. Are there other questions?
Counsel made the statement, and I'm not sure I'm characterizing correctly, but that they were one of the reasons that they helped get this landfill permitted was so they wouldn't have to go out and buy the property. I don't understand that argument.
Well, I think the reasoning of the city at that time was the FAA regulations did prohibit landfills within 10,000 feet of the runway. That would be a significant change in their ability to use the property because it would reduce it from a valid landfill site to nothing, pretty much, to agricultural use. So I think they did feel like they would have to come in and purchase the property in that situation.
Is there evidence in the record that the city initially budgeted monies to purchase the land in lieu of the permit?
What there is there's a line item in the budget that says, in connection with operating the new airport, land acquisition of landfills and it's, or landfill purchases, and it's plural. So you can interpret that how you want. I'm not sure. I think there is testimony that the city did feel like they were going to have to buy this property.
Mr. McLeish made the comment that I think he said the Griggs case demonstrated that there, when you're taking land for an airport, the government is obligated to take the land for the approach because it is just as much a part of the airport as not, and they can't avoid trying to buy the property just because that's not where the airstrip goes. Now, he seems to indicate that the Griggs case would be squarely on this case. You've got this that's in the approach to the runway, and the city has just tried to avoid buying it, and they're trying to say, well, you can use it for landfill, but as a practical matter, they cut the use in half because there is an approach.
And he says the Griggs case says you've got to do that, which prompted the question from the court saying, well, that's it, why are we arguing about everything else? So what's your response to that?
Well, that certainly reads the substantial interference test out of the three-part test that was most recently confirmed in Brown, and which they've submitted is the correct standard. So I think we'd be changing the law pretty significantly so that the air is no longer a public highway.
You could say that when an airplane is 100 feet off the ground, that is essentially, you can't, because the airplane hasn't literally touched the ground, you can't claim that the ground hasn't been taken for the use of the airport just because somebody might be able to go and use a landfill that's a foot high or something. I mean, in the Greece case, basically saying if you're talking about the approach to the runway under certain circumstances, that's as a matter of law meets the test of Brown and Cosby, a substantial change in use of the land. It becomes the front door to an airport.
Well, I don't read it that way. I read it as the substantial interference test is still the third part of the test, that just because they're low and frequent, that's not a gotcha you've got a taking in that situation. There are going to be situations where flying at that level will definitely be a substantial interference, and we've seen those in these cases where there's a change in use. But with landfill property, there has not been, and so it doesn't get you there.
And let me get back to my question, because I'm still confused as to why the city felt like they would have needed to go out there and buy that property if the permit was not given. The easement was dated in 82, right?
Yes.
And so therefore it was burdened with a navigation easement.
It wouldn't be a problem of the flights over the property. It would be the problem from the FAA regulations that say you can't use it the way you're permitted. You can have no landfill there at all.
Right. And in 82, when that easement was given, you could not have a landfill there.
No, you could. It just was limited in height.
By the FAA?
No, the FAA regulations apparently don't apply near military airports. So they were allowed in 1988 to obtain a permit, even though it was within 10,000 feet of the runway of a military airport. The FAA regulations kicked in when the airport converted from military to civilian.
So doesn't that impact the analysis that was being offered here by questions, that we have to compare this as a pre-existing military installation and now as a civilian installation? Don't we really compare civilian installation per FAA rules with now civilian installation?
I don't think so, because the easement has continually been in place. The FAA regulations have changed. The easement has always been in place, so there's never been an ability to build higher than the limits in the easement. There have always been military flights over the property, and contrary to what Mr. McFish said, there is testimony that between the time the keys were handed over in 93 and at least through 1996, there will continue to be 33,000 flights over the property that were military flights.
So the military height restrictions in the easement are,
yes,
what kept it from vertically expanding?
In the clearance easement and the navigation easement, yes. But it's mostly the clearance easement, because you can't build anything over the ceiling. That's what the clearance easement says. That's always been in place on the property. You can have a landfill, it just can't go up past the ceiling.
And the FAA would have said no landfill with a civilian airport. But they made an exception, or they changed the regulations here to allow it at least as a floor what it was contained in the easement.
Yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the argument for the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.